Major art theft in Boston overnight. Two thieves posing as police officers overpowered museum guards.
Very dramatically said, gentlemen, this is a robbery.
A part of our heritage has been stolen.
This horrible thing occurred in 1990. Everything changed because of that.
Someone on the inside helped the thieves.
From the guys who brought you Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space.
Empty Frames will be available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts on February 6th.
Today's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code undisclosed at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and joining me are attorneys, investigators, and bloggers, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Now, January 13th, 1999, is the seminal date in this case. That is the day that Haman Lee would leave school and disappear forever. Today, we get to the heart of the state's case. The center of gravity in this murder charge against Adnan, a wormhole that warps timelines and maybe the most mysterious figure in the story, according even to Serial. Today we look at Jay's day. Who was Jay? Jay was a former Woodlawn High School student, graduated a year before Adnan and Hay. He knew them primarily because of Stephanie, his girlfriend. Stephanie and Jay had dated since middle school. Stephanie had been friends with Adnan since middle school. They were pretty close. They were in the magnet program together, and they had been crowned king and queen of the junior prom in the spring of 1998. But the real question for a lot of people has always been, were Jay and Adnan friends? Now, according to the statements we have, both at trial and police statements, whether made by Jay or Adnan or Jen. Jen was also a 1998 Woodlawn High School graduate and a friend of Jay's and very much involved in the prosecution of the case. But according to all those folks, it seems like they actually weren't really friends.
When you say Jay and Adnan were like best friends?
Oh, no, not at all.
They were like casual acquaintances.
Casual acquaintances.
That was Jen being interviewed by the police in 1999. Now here's Jay at trial on the stand in 2000.
What you said to them on the 13th was that you weren't really tight with Adnan.
No, that's correct.
I mean, that was the truth back then, wasn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
You weren't really tight with Adnan.
No, ma'am.
You described him as an acquaintance, right?
Yes, ma'am.
As opposed to a friend.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that the only thing is that you might be at a party where he was. Is that right?
Once, yes.
And that's what you told them.
Yes.
We start the day with Adnan dropping off his car with Jay. They both agree on the time. There's a 10:45 a.m. call to Jay, after which Adnan comes by his house. The problem with telling the story about Jay's day is that Jay has given a minimum of 7 different stories about what happened on January 13th. 4 police interviews, 2 trial testimonies, and most recently, an interview he gave to The Intercept.
Simply put, these stories are not consistent at all. Despite the prosecution's claim at trial, there's no spine to Jay's story that holds it together. There's very little detail that's consistent across really even 2 of these accountings by Jay. And even if we ignore the minor details, there's simply not consistency in the big picture of what Jay is telling to the cops and eventually the jury at trial. When we really break it down, there's only a few things that have been consistent throughout Jay's story, and they're pretty minor. And so first, he consistently says that Hay's body was buried in Lincoln Park, although the time for this burial varies quite dramatically. He does consistently say that at least one of the instruments that was used to bury Hay's body was a shovel. And he does say it came from one of his relatives' houses, but he doesn't say which house consistently across interviews. He does acknowledge he had Adnan's car and phone on January 13th. He does consistently say that he was at Jen's house on January 13th until at least 3:40, which of course is inconsistent with the state's theory of the case at trial that Hay was killed by 2:36, which is when the Best Buy call took place. And then finally, he is consistent that at some point on January 13th, Adnan showed him Hay's body in the trunk of her Sentra, although both the time and the location of this trunk pop vary quite meaningfully across his interviews and testimony. And so when we look at these consistencies in Jay's story, they really mean nothing without, again, this big spine and structure that holds it together. For instance, the shovels. Sometimes he says there was one shovel, sometimes it's two shovels, sometimes there's a pick involved, sometimes he's helping to bury the body, sometimes not. Whose house did they come from? Were they from his mother's house, his grandmother's house? And so we have all these various stories about the burial in terms of the trunk pop. Where did that take place? Was it the Woodlawn Library? Was it a strip off of Edmondson Avenue? Was it Franklintown Road? The Best Buy, the story at trial. Was it a pool hall, as he told his friend? Was it a gas station? Was it at his grandmother's house? And so if we look through all these stories up until 2014, they vary wildly. And then finally in the Intercept interview, he actually says he lied to the police initially and said the trunk pop happened at Kathy's house, despite that never being disclosed to the defense at trial. And so what we see is when we try to decipher what Jay is saying in these various statements, it's almost meaningless to do so because these accountings are so very different. And in fact, he's admitted himself that he has lied in various statements about the events of January 13th, 1999. And so that then leaves us just with two things that we can look at in trying to decipher what aspects of Jay's day might in fact be reality. And the first is to look at other witnesses and what they have to say about interacting with Jay on January 13th. And the second is to see the evolution of Jay's story, where it started and how it got from point A to point Z when he eventually testified at trial.
Now, we only have statements from two witnesses who say that they saw Jay on January 13th, and that's Kathy and Jen. Not her real name, Kathy, of course. We'll look at the following events. First, when Jay went over to Jen's house in the morning. Second, what did Jen and Jay do while he was at her house? Third, when did Jay leave her house? Next, when did Jen and Jay meet up again later that evening? And finally, what did they actually do that evening?
When did Jay get to Jen's house? According to Jen, she called Jay sometime between 10 a.m. and noon that day to invite him to come over to hang out. After work, she went home and, you know, maybe an hour later, Jay showed up.
So I want to say I got home probably between 12:30 and 1. And then I want to say that Jay got there probably between 1 and 1:30. Maybe as late as 2, but I don't think it was that late. I think it was more around 1:30 time.
That was Jen talking to the cops. So Jen says that she got home first and later Jay walks in. Jay says exactly the opposite. He says he went over to the Pusateri home, not to hang out with Jen, but to hang out with Mark, Jen's little brother.
Was anybody home?
Yes, her brother was.
Did you have the occasion to go inside?
Yes, we entered, we went down the basement, we played video games, probably for about half an hour before anyone called.
Was Jennifer home?
Not yet.
What time does she get home?
She gets off work at about 12:30. Takes her, she lollygagged in the house, I'd say probably about 1:30.
So which one is it? Did Jen call Jay to tell him to hang out with her that afternoon? Or did Jay go to the Pusateri house to hang out with Mark and Jen just happened to show up later?
What did Jay and Jen do while Jay was at the Pusateri residence? Turns out that Jay and Jen can't even agree on that. And so both of them do mention playing video games at some point, but other than that, they don't really agree on anything else. And so according to Jen, Jay and she were at her place all afternoon, and Jay never left. But according to Jay, he actually left multiple times. And in addition to that, they also don't have agreement on the phone calls that Jay received while he was at Jen's house. When Jay testifies at trial, he remembers that both Adnan and Jen were calling him while he was at Jen's house. But if you look at the phone log, that doesn't make much sense. because between noon and 3:30, we have three calls that are made to Jen's home phone. And if Jay's at Jen's house, why is he calling her? And meanwhile, if Jen is at the house with him, why is she making calls to Jay? She doesn't really contradict Jay's statements about the phone calls. She really just simply doesn't remember them. And so when the cops tell her about the phone calls, they're the ones who were telling her they took place on January 13th, but Jen herself actually doesn't remember these calls happening on the 13th. And so let's look at the question and answer between Jen and the police.
You indicate several phone calls come into your residence. However, you're not sure whether it was Jay's cell phone or the telephone.
Right. I don't remember the phone name, but you told me that he called my house. So apparently it was either on the cell phone or on my house line number.
Okay. Jen's memory of the day is actually pretty hazy. And according to Jay, that shouldn't be the case because Jay gave her big news.
Do you have any conversation with her about what is going to occur?
Yes. Later that afternoon, we went out to her car. I think we ran to the store, come back to get some soda or something like that. And we were sitting in her car, and I told her that I think that Adnan was going to kill Hay.
According to Jay, then, Jen really didn't react. Jen really didn't care much about what Jay had to say about Adnan's plans to kill Hay.
You took it so seriously that you told Jennifer.
Yes.
And what did Jennifer say?
I don't think she believed me. I don't remember exactly what she said, but I don't think she believed me.
Jennifer really never liked Kay, correct?
Yeah.
Did she actually even care?
Not really.
Did she say, I can't believe this, we've got to stop this?
No.
What did she say to you?
That motherfucker's crazy.
And that's it.
According to Jay, Jen's lack of surprise about the news actually makes some sense because he had actually already told Jen about Adnan's plans to kill Hay the prior day.
He returned me to my house. I paged Jennifer Pusateri. Yes, I paged Jennifer Pusateri. We went to Gilston Park. She had her dog with her. There I told her what the conversation me and Adnan had earlier that day. And her reaction was just about the same. And then later that day, I went to Champs, celebrated my birthday.
It's either Jay's lying about telling Jen of Adnan's plans to kill Hay, or it's Jen who's lying about her knowledge of the murder plot. But any way you slice it, we have Jen and Jay telling completely different stories about what happened when they hung out on the afternoon of January the 13th.
When Jay left her house. This is actually the one point that Jen and Jay firmly agree on. Problem is that they both agree Jay left Jen's house at a time that completely invalidates the state's timeline. Both Jen and Jay say over and over again, he left the house at 3:30, 3:40, and Jen says as late as 4:15 even. But the state's theory of the case is that Hay was dead by 2:35, and the come and get me call was made at 2:36 p.m. If Jay is saying that Adnan told him to expect a call at 3:30, and that Adnan didn't actually call until 3:40, there's no way the state's timeline can work. It just can't. It's done. And here's what Jay said.
Adnan had called on the hardline while I was at Jen's house.
Okay.
He had told me he was going to need me to pick him up at a certain time. That was 3:30. I waited till 3:30. He didn't call. I left the house with his car and cell phone.
It's worth noting here that Jay doesn't actually say that the come and get me call was received while he was at Jen's house. He says that at 3:30, Adnan hadn't called like he said he would, so Jay just decided to leave. He went to his friend Jeff's house. Before he got to the door, Adnan did call, and that's when the come and get me, the bitch is dead call happened.
So you're playing this waiting game, waiting for him to give you a call.
Mm-hmm.
Does he call you at some point in time?
Yeah.
What time does he call you?
Time I remember talking to him, like actually having a conversation with him, was about 3:40 something.
But we have Jay saying that the come and get me call was definitely at 3:40. He is very consistent on this point. There's nothing else that Jay manages to say in almost every interview. And Jen agrees with him. She also says that Jay left her place at 3:40.
He was going to come around 3:30. So we hung out at my house. And then I guess around 3:30, 3:45, Jay got a call. And then I don't know what was said during the conversation. Then Jay got another call. Well, we got off the phone, and then another call came in. And I don't know whether it was the same person or who it was. And I don't know whether it was on my phone or whether it was on the cell phone that Jay had. Then Jay left my house probably around 3:34, 4:15. Well, after 3:45, between 3:45 and 4:15.
So this is the one point where Jay and Jen's stories coalesce. Both of them aren't consistent about much, but they are both completely consistent that in this case, Jay didn't leave Jen's house until at least 3:40 p.m. And that's significant because if we believe this, it completely undermines a couple of key components of the state's case. And the first is what was referenced as the Nisha call on the Serial podcast. Again, this was the claim by the state that Adnan had to have killed Hay and been with his phone by 3:32, which is when the Nisha call was made. Well, that's entirely inconsistent with the story by both Jay and Jen that Jay was still at Jen's house until at least 3:40 p.m. And if we look at Jay specifically, this isn't simply a matter of, well, maybe he was wrong about the time. Jay very specifically says, I was waiting for a call at 3:30 p.m. That call didn't come till later. So it's not him just guessing at the time. He has a very specific signpost as to why this call was after 3:30. Second, if we look at Adnan's call log, there isn't an incoming call anywhere around 3:40 p.m. The last call before that is 3:15 p.m. and the next one is 4:30. And so Jay and Jen's story about Jay getting this call from Adnan at around 3:40 or so doesn't match up with any recorded call on Adnan's call log. And that means that really the only detail about Jay's trip to Jen's house that has their stories matching up either has to be false or it completely destroys the state's narrative of the case.
Is there something that interferes with your happiness, disturbs your peace of mind, or is preventing you from achieving your goals? If so, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp offers over 4,000 licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleep, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Yeah. There's a lot of things that we deal with in our everyday life, and it's hard if you don't have a professional to help you. Now, let me make this clear. This is not a crisis line. That's not what BetterHelp does. BetterHelp provides counseling services that are affordable. Finally, you can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Everything you share is confidential, and it's really convenient. Get help at your own time. And believe me, if you have any idea what it's like to try to get a therapist in the real world, which is, you know, important to do if you need to do it, it can be really time consuming. It's hard to schedule stuff and it's pretty expensive. But with BetterHelp, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions plus chat and text with your own therapist. And if for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time without any additional charge. And like I said earlier, it's a truly affordable option for undisclosed listeners. And undisclosed listeners get 10% off your first month with discount code undisclosed. So why not get started today? Go to BetterHelp, BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/undisclosed. Simply fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a counselor that you'll love. So don't waste any more time. Don't delay any more getting the support and help that you might need. That's BetterHelp.com/undisclosed.
But why are Jen and Jay both sticking to this point? We know Jay will change his story. Why not here? Why is it always 3:40? Well, that's kind of an important part of their tale because that's their alibi. Jen and Jay were together until 3:40, a time when we know Hay had already been intercepted and was probably already killed. So if Jen and Jay were together until 3:40 p.m., like they say, then neither could be responsible for her murder.
According to Jay, Adnan calls him. He meets him at Best Buy. And then there's a few different versions of what happens next. Jay says he drops Adnan back off for track practice, and Adnan calls him again after it's done to pick him up. Adnan, however, says that no such thing ever happened. He never left the school campus, which, by the way, includes the library area, until after track practice. Now, if you recall from episode one, it seems that Adnan was at track that day on time at 3:30 p.m., and that track ended around 5:30 p.m. This coincides with the call patterns on the cell phone. At 5:14, there's a call to the phone that goes to voicemail. But at 5:38, a call is made to Krista, who is a friend of Adnan's, which means at this point, Adnan, Jay, and the phone are probably all together. Jay, in fact, does initially tell the police that they went to get food and they smoked pot, and then the whole Kathy episode comes in. So it seems clear from the call records that Jay and Adnan parted ways by around 8 p.m., but before that, they were together for a couple of hours, during which Adnan received a call from Hay's brother and then spoke to the officer who was with her brother.
So at some point, Jay leaves Jen's house. Jen then goes to pick up her parents from work, and she got back home around 6:30 p.m. Both Jay and Jen agree that they saw each other again that evening. But the two of them don't come close to remembering the same thing about how that happened or what they were doing. When and how did Jay and Jen meet up again? Jay tells the cops that after the burial in Lincoln Park and after Adnan abandoned Hay's car at the vacant lot on Edgewood Road, he went home. He and Adnan stopped by Westview Mall to toss some shovels or shovel or pick in a dumpster. And then Jay was dropped off at his house. And it's only there that Jen calls him.
He's my friend Jen. Back to page her from his phone to my house. I get out of his car, I go in my house, Jen calls me back, I tell her I need to talk to her, it's real important for her to come get me. She comes right over, I take my clothes from that day, I put them in a plastic bag, I go out to the car with Jen, I tell her what happened.
What the prosecution argues at trial, and what's presented in serial, is the Westview Mall story. About how Adnan dropped Jay off there, and that's when Jen sees Adnan, and he says, hey, what's up, girl? But that doesn't come from Jay. That's all Jen's story.
And I guess a little bit after 8, around 8, between 8 and 8:30, I'd say Jay paged me and told me to come pick him up at Westview Mall parking lot in front of Value City. I got to Westview Mall parking lot in front of Value City, probably between 8 and 8:30, shortly after the page came through.
So Jen says that she picked Jay up at the mall, and the prosecution goes with her story at trial. But Jay was clear. He went right home after the burial. Jen picked him up from his house. And him going to the mall to meet Jen wouldn't make any sense because he needed to change clothes. He had dirt on him from the burial. That doesn't match what Jen says either, because Jen's clear too. When she got Jay from the mall, there was no sign that he'd been busy in the woods burying a body.
You notice anything bad as clothing? Shoveled, soiled, or anything like that?
No, they didn't look dirty. They didn't look any different than they normally looked. Than it looked before, like when he was at my house at 1 or 1:30. They didn't look any different than then.
According to Jay, after Jen picked him up at his house, she took him to throw away his clothes at a nearby dumpster.
On the way up.
Jen had come over to your house to pick you up.
Uh-huh.
You told her what had occurred.
Yes.
And you got in the car with her.
Yes.
And you were going to dump your clothes.
Yes.
Jen also says that she helped Jay throw away the clothes he was wearing while burying the body in Lincoln Park. But she doesn't say it happens that night on the 13th. She says that that whole event doesn't happen till the next day, the following afternoon, when she picks Jay up after work.
I woke up the next morning. I guess I went through my normal 6:30 to... till 9 routine, taking everybody to work, myself getting to work. And I think I probably went to work the next day, as long as it wasn't a Saturday or Sunday. And then sometime during the 14th, on that day, I went to see Jay again at his house. I picked him up. And he had his boots with him, as well as his clothes and jacket that he had on the night before. And he asked me if I would take him to F&M parking lot.
Okay, the last point is point five. And going to the end of the day, what did Jay and Jen do that evening? And what we see here is that Jay and Jen actually disagree on what happened for the rest of the night. And in fact, the one point that they agree on, that they went to visit Stephanie, is actually contradicted by Stephanie's own account. And that's backed up by the records of her basketball game that day. And so Jay and Jen do both say at some point after she picks him up, she takes him over to Stephanie's house. So they are in agreement here. And so let's look first at Jen's statement.
He was like, you have to take me to go see my girlfriend now. I took him. I think I took him to see Stephanie because he was very concerned for Stephanie's well-being.
And next, let's look at Jay's statement.
From there.
Yes.
Where did you go?
From there, I went to my girlfriend Stephanie's house. She had a late game. I stopped. It was her birthday. I spoke to her. We chatted for a little bit. Then we left there, and I went to Christy and Jeff's, where I remained for the rest of the evening.
The problem with this is that even though Jay and Jen both do agree they went to Stephanie's house after they wiped down the shovels at Westview Mall, their story simply can't be true. That's because we know that Stephanie had a basketball game on the evening of January 13th, and that she didn't get home from that game until 10 o'clock p.m. According to Stephanie herself, it wasn't until 11:30 p.m. when Jay stopped by her house. And here's the interesting thing. We've been told this whole time that the entire purpose of Jay borrowing this car was to buy the birthday present for Stephanie, but according to Stephanie herself, Jay didn't give her the present until the next day. As the records prove, she didn't get home from her basketball game until 10 o'clock p.m. That contradicts both Jay and Jen, who both say they went to see Stephanie at around 8:30 p.m. And so that leaves the question of what exactly were Jay and Jen doing during that hour and a half between 8:30 and 10.
After the supposed trip to Stephanie's house, Jay says that they go to not her real name, Kathy, and Jeff's place. Now, I'm going to pause here for a second. Not her real name, Kathy, is how we've been referring to this young lady since Serial started. But the problem now is that her real name is everywhere. It is recently been mentioned in the state's brief in Adnan's post-conviction. It's part of the transcripts that are all over the internet. And it's going to be in the clip that you're going to hear right now. Her real name is Christy. So going forward, we're going to actually refer to not her real name, Kathy, by her real name, which is Christy. So Jen says that after Stephanie's, her and Jay went to a party with her sorority sisters with her friend Mike.
Did you go to Christy's house or did you go to
Christy's house? No, I think I went to Candace before I went to Christy's house.
And Jay was with you?
Yes, Jay was with me.
And where is the campus?
UMBC, Wilkins Avenue.
Within the campus, how long did you stay at the sorority house?
I want to say we were there maybe about an hour. We didn't stay as long as I wanted to, but that's because we still had to get to Christy's house. I tend to make a lot of plans and have to go a lot of places because I have a lot of friends that like to hang out, I guess. I try to make everybody happy. It was my friend Mike's birthday. He was giving me a hard time about leaving because he was like, I never hang out long enough, and blah, blah, blah. But I left anyhow. And after I left there, I went to Christy's house.
Can I just point out for a moment how odd this is? Jen has supposedly just learned that someone she knew has just murdered someone else she knew. And her first concern is to make sure she doesn't actually miss her friend Mike's party. I mean, true, she never really liked Hay anyway, but Jen's reaction to Jay's news is baffling. Of course, Jay says this whole post-murder sorority trip never actually happened. Jen lied. Or maybe she was mistaken. He says both at trial.
Never told the police about going to the sorority party, did you?
No.
You didn't tell them on the 28th, right?
No.
And you didn't tell them on the 15th of March, right? Mm-hmm. And you didn't tell them on the 13th of April, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't tell them on the 9th, 7th of September, did you?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't tell them at any time, did you?
No, ma'am.
And that's not the truth, is it?
I went to a sorority party?
Well, what is the truth you would have us believe is that you did go to a sorority party, right?
No, ma'am.
Yeah, that's something that your very good friend Jen says, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, to summarize, Jay and Jen agree they went to Stephanie's shortly after Jay got picked up. But that part of the story can't be true because Stephanie wasn't home then. Then Jen says they went to a party at UMBC and then went to Christy and Jeff's, but Jay says he went to Christy's immediately. Christy now also says that Jen and Jay came back to her place later that night, but we know that there's a good reason to think she might have been wrong about that day because of the conference reference from an earlier episode. So could Jen have been also thinking of the wrong day? A day when Stephanie might have been home around 8:30? Now, on the other hand, Jay and Jen's story do match up at some points and have some very rough overlaps, even if they diverge on the details. So does that mean Jen is actually corroborating Jay? Well, the answer to that is no. Because Jay's story and Jen's story were not given independently. When the cops interviewed Jay, they told him about what Jen had said and where his statement was inconsistent with hers. This doesn't happen in the tape portion of the interview, so we know it had to have happened in the pre-interview, which means Jay was given an opportunity to alter and adapt his statement so that it was in line with what Jen had said. Here's Jay testifying on the stand.
During that interview, they confronted you with things Jen Cusatiri said.
Yes, ma'am.
And you knew more about her interview with the police because they told you about it.
Yes, ma'am.
They advised you that during what they called the first interview, that there were a lot of inconsistencies, did they not?
Yes, ma'am.
And they then asked you to address them, did they not?
Yes, ma'am.
So that means that the fact that Jay and Jen both said something isn't necessarily proof that that thing actually happened. It could have easily been the result of the police telling Jen what Jay said and then them telling Jay what Jen said.
And so that brings us then to the final witness who apparently saw Jay on January 13th, and that's Mark Pusateri, Jen's brother. And as we know, Jay in his first and second police statement said he went over to the Pusateri residence to hang out with Mark and not Jen. And according to Jay, Mark and he played video games together, made a trip to the mall, and it wasn't until later that Jen got home. And here's the big problem, the big gap or omission we have in this case, which is to say, we have no idea what Mark has to say about the events of January 13th. According to the state's records, there was never any interview between the police and Mark. And so this person, whom according to Jay, is the reason why he went to the Pusateri house, never talked to by police to determine whether, in fact, Jay was telling the truth.
And this seems crucial to me because Jay, in his very first interview, first recorded interview, says, yeah, Mark Pusateri saw me. We played video games together. If he's using that as an alibi for a murder, you'd have to think he was confident that Mark would back him up. So why wouldn't the police talk to Mark and at least confirm that basic detail?
We've always known that Jay lies. Jay admits he lies. The real enigma here is why. The first time I realized that Susan Simpson might be the person who actually solves what happened in this case was when I read a blog she wrote about Jay's police statements. I've had these statements for years. You know, I've looked at them, I've read and reread them. And I always said, something's so wrong. This is all so wrong. What is going on here? Jay lies, he admits it. But no one, not even Sarah Koenig, could figure out why he lied. What was animating these lies? What is the utility of these lies? What is the method behind this madness? And then bam, Susan figured it out. She figured out what no one else in all these years, not even Serial, could find out. Because all this time we had been trying to plot Jay's dream. But it turns out It was never his dream to begin with.
If you've read my blog, you know that I've spent a lot of time analyzing Jay's interview statements. There's a lot of weird stuff in there, but when you read a transcript, the context for a lot of statements is lost. When parts of the dialogue don't seem to make sense or don't add up, you're left wondering if there's some sort of tone of voice or some inflection or something else about the interaction that could explain why they're saying the things they said. So when I finally got the audio for the interviews a couple weeks ago, I was pretty excited. The first thing that stood out to me was the pauses. They're long, they're frequent, they don't show up in the transcript. So I had no idea exactly how long Jay was waiting in between answers. He didn't know what to say a lot of the time. You just hear 10, 15, 20 seconds of him apparently thinking of how to answer a question. And they don't show up in the transcripts because they just show what he said without the gaps. So then I noticed something else. The same thing kept happening over and over again. To show you what I'm talking about, let's play a clip from one of the interviews. Here, Jay is describing what happens after he and Adnan go to Patapsco State Park to smoke weed. Or, as Jay put it, to go rockin' in the park.
Okay. What happens then?
We leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to schooling, and I dropped him off.
Did you catch that? Jay is responding to someone after that pause. And not just that, there's a tap tap, and then Jay says, oh, okay. And suddenly, a moment later, he knows the answer. I first heard the tapping after I listened through the clips a few times, and then shortly after that, I found a document in the police file that seemed to correlate with those tappings. And I spent a lot of time checking and double-checking to make sure I wasn't hearing something that wasn't there, or that this wasn't a tapping that appeared all over the interviews in all kinds of places. But again and again, the pattern held. Jay gets confused, pauses too long, or starts to say the wrong thing, and tap, tap, tap. And Jay knows the answer suddenly. So finally, I got the clips together, and I sent them to Amar, our sound guy. I asked him to make sure those sounds were really there, so he cleaned up the audio for me. And yeah, those sounds are there. Let's play that same clip again, but this time with the audio cleaned up.
Okay. What happens then?
We leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to schooling.
Jay forgot what happened after Patapsco. He didn't remember the next sequence of events involved him taking Adnan to track so that Adnan can set up an alibi. But a tapping reminds him.
Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there.
To show what the tapping's actually doing, let's look at another clip. This one's from the first interview, and it's describing what happens after Adnan and Jay leave Edmondson Avenue and head up towards the park and ride.
Mama followed me, and so I get in the car and I follow him, and we end up at the 70 park and ride off of, Kirkland.
What is that? It sounds like Jay's referring to something, like a map. In fact, there are a series of maps in the police file, with the cell towers labeled and the times of key calls scribbled in. These maps don't display most road names, but they do list some of the roads, and Cook's Lane is one of the roads labeled, leading directly to the park and ride. In fact, almost without exception, the only roads that Jay is capable of naming are the roads that are displayed on these maps. Here's what Jay says when asked to describe what happened when Patrick didn't answer his phone. That's the 3:59 p.m. call that Jay says was a call to try and find weed. Now, in this clip, listen for the paper shuffling that occurs just as Jay switches to the part of the story involving the trip to Forest Park to try and score weed.
What do you do then after
Phone message.
We head to Forest Park to see if we can find a corner salesman there. We go down there, we buy 2 dime sacks. We turn around. I believe we stop to get blunts on Rogers and Gwinoak and Rogers, in the corner of Gwinoak and Rogers.
Again, we have a long pause, and suddenly Jay comes up with the answer. He names a corner. Rogers and Gwinoak's. For a guy who says he doesn't really know street names, that's oddly specific. And it also never came up in his first interview, so how is he suddenly remembering now the name of a corner that he didn't know back then? Well, it turns out that among those roads listed on the maps, in the Forest Park area, there are only a couple corners that are named. And yeah, Gwinoak and Rogers are among the 2 most prominently displayed. In the next part of the interview, this is also from the first interview, Jay describes how he went to meet Adnan off of Edmondson Avenue after getting the come and get me call. Jay immediately starts talking about how he then followed Adnan to some other location. He's jumping to the part of the story where they go to the park and ride. But the cops stop him. They prompt him to get back on track and to tell about the next important event in his story.
So you arrived 20 minutes later, this location on Edmondson Avenue. Then what happened?
I followed him out.
Did you get out of your car when you get on Edmondson Avenue and have any conversations with him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
We got out. He's walking around with gray gloves on.
Red gloves, are they?
Winter gloves.
Cloth gloves, or?
Yeah, they're like wool with leather palms in them. And that spark, I was, I'll be walking around with gloves on for it. And then, I'm sorry. He goes, I did it. You don't fucking believe me, I did it. And he pops the trunk open, and he's like, he's all bent up and some balloon in the trunk.
Okay, in case you didn't catch that, listen to that last part one more time. Jay started making up some conversation that he had with Adnan about his gloves, a conversation Jay never ever mentions again and has no point. The cops don't like it. They stop him. And then Jay changes the direction of his story.
Oh, and he's walking around with gray gloves on.
Gray gloves, are they?
Winter gloves.
Cloth gloves, or?
Yeah, they're like wool with leather palms. And that spark, I was, I'll be walking around with gloves on for it. And then, I'm sorry. He goes, I did it. You don't fucking believe me, I did it. And he pops the trunk open, and he's like, he's all bent up and some balloon in the trunk.
First, Jay apologizes. Why is he apologizing? Because someone in that room is giving him a look or a stare, telling him he screwed up. He got it wrong. Then you hear a tap-tap sound, and Jay says the word pups, as if he's reading it. And then confidently, he launches into the story that he'd forgotten before, the part about how Adnan pops the trunk open and shows him Hay's body. Another thing I've discussed on my blog is how convoluted Jay's whole story about the burial really is. It's way over-elaborate and involves 3 or 4 trips back and forth from a parking spot to the burial site, and involves an extremely inefficient series of events. And Jay can't keep track of it. He repeatedly gets confused, trying to describe where all these pieces are moving about, trying to describe where the shovels are, where the car is, where Adnan's car is, and where Hay's car is. And he often forgets one of the cars, and he'll end up describing how Adnan was walking around the streets, forgetting that Adnan should have had Hay's car to drive around in. So when Jay tries to describe in the interview where Tay's car was located, guess what we hear again? That's right. Tap, tap, tap.
And both cars are parked back in the parking spot?
No. Just his car. Her car had been moved to the spot around the corner prior to us digging the hole.
Let's play that cleaned up again so you can hear it better. We have McGillivary asking Jay where the cars are and trying to subtly remind Jay, are they parked back in the parking spot? Jay says, well, no, her car is... dot, dot, dot. And suddenly he knows. It's around the corner. And this spot is shown on the maps. You can see the burial site, and you can see the road, where it does kind of a dog leg back to where the cars were supposed to be. Someone's tapping on that corner.
And both cars are parked back in the parking spot?
No. Just his car. Her car had been moved to the spot around the corner prior to us digging the hole.
The detectives are not shy about reminding Jay how many cars he's supposed to have at any point in the story and where those cars are supposed to be. But as the interview goes on, they start getting less and less subtle about it. In fact, Detective McGillivray starts sounding downright exasperated. And I don't really blame him, because Jay screws up quite a bit. So Jay makes his umpteenth mistake of the day, and you can hear the frustration from the detectives.
What do you do then?
We drive to Westview. I told him to take me home, and on the way going home, we passed by Westview, and he said I better get rid of this stuff.
You've got two cars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm missing time spots. Yes, I'm sorry. We leave. We still do have two cars. He motions for me to follow him. I follow him. We're driving around all in the city. I ask him, where the hell are we going? And he says, where's a good strip at? I need a strip.
Okay, so McGillivray reminds Jay that they've got two cars, and Jay apologizes and adopts it into a story. It's worth noting, though, that Jay immediately forgets again that there are two cars in the story. Did you hear where Jay started describing a conversation that he and Adnan had while they're driving around in two separate cars? Apparently, Adnan was able to telepathically communicate with Jay during this whole series of events. But the two-car issue aside, Jay makes a really interesting comment during this exchange. In response to McGillivray's exasperated sigh, he says, I'm missing and top spots.
You've got two cars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm missing time spots. Yes, I'm sorry. We leave. We still do have two cars. So
what on earth is he referring to? I'm missing top spots? It turns out that the police file doesn't just have maps. It also has a document called Jay's Chronology. It has a numbered list of 24 events about what occurred on January 13th. And event number 22 starts at the very bottom of the first page and continues on to the second page. It says, Jay in Honda follows Adnan in Nissan to 300 Edgewood, where Nissan is dumped. So what is Jay missing? And what are the top spots? Could it be that Jay meant he was missing page 2 of the chronology, and then when he found where page 2 was, he was reading off the top spots of it? Sounds like it. Now, there are also other indications in the interviews that Jay is following off the chronology. For example, let's take what happens after Adnan receives the phone call from Officer Adcock. According to the Jay's Chronology document, the next two events are numbers 16 and 17. Number 16 says, Adnan asks Jay to help get rid of the body. They drive to Jay's house, get shovels, then to park and ride. Number 17 says, Jay in Honda follows Adnan in Nissan to Rolling Road, to Dogwood, to Holyfield, to Johnny Cake, and back to Woodlawn. And eventually to Dogwood, to Kernan, to other streets, then the burial site. Let's hear how Jay tries to describe these two events in his story.
We go back to the 70 parking lot. He gets out of his car, tells me to follow him. He gets into her car. He drives it. We drove around to a whole bunch of different places, some off of Rowan Road, some off of Dogwood Road. Finally, he goes down past Lincoln Park. No, this is wrong. I'm sorry. I missed something. We leave Christy and Jeff's, and I ask him to drop me off, and we go back to my house. And when we're standing on my porch, that's when he tells me that we have to go back. We have to get rid of the body. We have to get rid of the body.
Jay apologizes and says that he missed something. Yeah, he did. He missed number 16. And eventually he realized it. and went back to add it to the story. And that brings us to Christy, aka not her real name, Kathy, and how it is she came to be part of the story. So Kathy says that Adnan and Jay visited her place on the 13th, and as we talked about earlier, her memories actually linked to a different day. So why does Kathy's apartment magically appear in Jay's later interviews? Well, it goes back to those maps, the one in the police file. In one map, the detectives have the location of a certain cell tower correctly marked. It's a tower that's next to Westview Mall, not too far from Jay's house. And in this map, the one the detectives were using, it also displays fast food restaurants. So right next to where the detectives have the cell tower marked, there's a McDonald's shown. It's on Rolling Road. Here's what Jay says in his first interview about the phone call Adnan received from Officer Adcock.
When he gets the call from the officer, mm-hmm. where are you guys? Are you up at the Park and Ride?
No, we're at a restaurant.
Where exactly? What's the name of the restaurant?
I think we're at McDonald's on Rolling Road.
On McDonald's Rolling Road?
Yeah.
At a McDonald's on Rolling Road. We know Jay was lying about this. He's admitted to it. So where did he get such an oddly specific lie from? I can think of one way that he might have been able to figure that out. There's this map of a cell tower that shows it right next to a McDonald's on Rolling Road. In the second interview, though, Jay suddenly says that he was at Kathy's when the cops called. In fact, that's the second trip that Jay had made to Kathy's that day. He says he was also at Kathy's an hour earlier, while Adnan was at track.
Where do you go? I was on my way home, but then I stopped off at Gilston Park and I smoked another blunt before I went home. And then I think I may have gone. Yeah, I went to Christy and Jeff's and he called me from the cell phone there. And then I left Christy and Jeff's. Hang on.
So once again, we have a long, awkward Jay pause. There's a tap. And Jay magically comes up with the right answer. Or in this case, the wrong answer, because there is absolutely no chance Jay was hanging out with Kathy from 4:30 to 5 p.m. that day. So why would the cops prompt Jay to give an incorrect answer? Well, remember that tower next to the McDonald's on Rolling Road? There's a second map showing the area around Kathy's apartment. In that map, though, they've taken the tower that was next to the McDonald's, and they've marked it about 3 miles south. There isn't a tower there. The cops got it wrong. There's some confusion over street names. But the cops thought the tower was there, and the spot they mistakenly placed the tower at is about a quarter of a mile from Kathy's apartment. That's the tower that calls are made on from 4:30 to 5 p.m. that day. So the detectives have this map where the cell tower that pings at 4:30 and 5 p.m. has been incorrectly placed next to Kathy's. And the cops think, well, the phone must be next to Kathy's apartment because that's what our maps are saying. So they need Jay to comply with their map and to say that, you know, he was at Kathy's when those calls were made. And even though he wasn't there and couldn't have been there, he complies and tells them that he was there from 4:30 to 5.
This is a pretty serious allegation here against the Baltimore Police Department. I mean, it's basically saying that they really coached Jay into giving the version of events they wanted. And if that sounds like something that could never happen, there was a similar case just a couple of years ago. There was a man by the name of Ezra Mabel, and he was convicted of murder. Specifically, the claim was that he killed a drug lord. And he was eventually released from prison and brought a civil case against the Baltimore Police Department, the mayor, the city. And his claim was that some of the testimony against him was coached. And some of the detectives in that case were the same detectives in this case. According to him, one of the two key eyewitnesses in the case was a woman who, according to the complaint, didn't even see anything having to do with the murder. In fact, it appeared she was high and or drunk during the interview. And the claim in his complaint is that she was threatened with being arrested unless she told the police that she had seen the defendant, Ezra Mabel, with a gun exiting the victim's car. And so, yes, pretty serious allegations here, but it's not the first time someone's claimed in a murder case in Baltimore would have claimed that witnesses against him were coached.
And let me just note here that on the stand at trial, Jay testified under cross-examination by Gutierrez that, in fact, the police had said to him that they would charge him with the murder if he, you know, was not acting as a witness. So what we have here then in layman's terms is what Colin mentioned, police coaching. Let me say that again. The police coached Jay through his statements. I don't even know if coaching is the right word. Maybe the right word is fed him his statements. They corrected him when he messed up. He apologized repeatedly. They gave him a map. They gave him a chronology to reference. And how do they manage to do that without saying a word so that it never showed up in the transcript? They did it by tapping. What's really frightening is, though, that not only were they able to coach and feed Jay into admitting details that were completely mundane, they took it to the extent that Jay admitted to some really serious stuff because of the coaching.
The detectives are repeatedly bullying Jay into giving answers that they want. The detectives will tell Jay that he needs to give a certain answer, and again and again, Jay complies. He does say what they tell him to say. And it's not that subtle either. For example, here's when the detectives are asking Jay about whether, on January 13th, he told Christy and Jeff about Hayes' murder.
If I told him, my exact words would have been that dude killed his girlfriend.
Yeah. Not if you told
him. Okay, I'm sorry.
What did you tell Jeff?
That dude killed his girlfriend.
And what did Jeff say to you?
For real? Oh, snap.
That's it.
This never happened. Jay didn't tell Jeff. Jay testified that this whole scene never occurred. But when the detective asked him to say, what did you tell Jeff? Jay agrees, makes up a story. He even makes up an answer for Jeff. For real? Oh, snap. And Jay doesn't just make up stories about who he told about the murder. He makes up stories about much more serious things. In fact, the police got Jay to falsely confess to accessory before the fact to murder, a crime that is itself punishable as murder.
He calls you that night to tell you, I'm going to kill her and I need your assistance.
No. He calls me, wants to know if he can hook up, and then he's going to kill her.
Okay. But you take that as he's going to need your assistance.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
That right there is conspiracy and accessory. Jay agreed to help Adnan with Hayes' murder. And again, we know this didn't happen because that phone call he's talking about on January 12th was 18 seconds. There is no way that Jay and Adnan discussed relationships, discussed the plan to kill Hay, and discussed where to get weed the next day, all in the space of not even half a minute. So why is Jay confessing to a crime that could put him in jail for life? If Jay is willing to make up a story that implicates himself in murder, why wouldn't he also be making up a story to implicate Adnan in murder?
Now, if you really paid attention to Serial, you'll remember that Jen was interviewed by the police first, twice in fact, before the police went and picked up Jay. According to Jen, she told Jay that the cops wanted to talk to her, and he told her, you know what, go ahead and talk to them and send them to me. Which may make you think, well, if Jen spoke to the cops first and her story was, you know, similar to Jay's, then maybe he wasn't actually coached. Jen had the same thing to say, kind of. But what if Jay had been speaking to the cops long before they got to Jen and long before Jay supposedly led them to the car? Did he lead them to the car? Next time on the Undisclosed Addendum. Special thanks to Amir Naji, our sound editor, Ramiro Marquez, who created our theme music, and Baluki, who provided our logo. Dennis Robinson is our executive producer. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the Trust. To learn more about the Trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.
Major art theft in Boston overnight. Two thieves posing as police officers overpowered museum guards.
Very dramatically said, gentlemen, this is a robbery.
A part of our heritage has been stolen.
This horrible thing occurred in 1990. Everything changed because of that.
Someone on the inside helped the thieves.
From the guys who brought you Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space.
Empty Frames will be available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts on February 6th.